My next guest spent 24 years in the United States Navy, the last nine of those serving in a unique position, that of White House physician. Her name is Dr. Connie Mariano. She's a retired Rear Admiral in the Navy. That's the rank she retired from in 2001. Since then, she's set up private practice in Scottsdale, Arizona, and now has written about her experience as Doctor to the Presidents in a book simply entitled The White House Doctor. Dr. Mariano, welcome to the Big 550 KTRS.
Thanks, Paul. It's good to be on your radio show.
Thank you. This was a real pleasure to read, and parts of it are fascinating. Parts of it are also a little bit scary, and I want to start with the scariest part of the job. I'm going to quote one sentence from the book that jumped right out at me. The specter of assassination hung over all of us. Is that the thing that goes through your mind every day when you go to work as the White House doctor? Today might be the day I have to save the president's life.
Honestly, it is. You know, you hear of the last attempt we had was on Ronald Reagan. Before then, it was the assassination of John Kennedy. And the nightmare for any White House doctor is that your first patient dies on your shift.
And you're there with them all the time for exactly that reason, right?
You are. You're there, you know, obviously for the routine medical things, but the major reason you're there, in case they're attacked or they have a heart attack, you're the first responder.
Okay, so tell me what that means to be around them all the time. It's easy at the White House. You have an office. What about when they're outside of the White House?
Well, the White House doctor rides in the motorcade. We ride in what's called the decoy limo, which makes you really feel comfortable when you hear that. You know, you're the decoy.
Yeah.
We also have a nurse or medic who rides in the support van, and we have an ambulance with us. And for every site or every city the president travels to, we have somebody from the medical unit, be a nurse, a medic, or PA, who greets us there, and they meet us there after doing an advance of all the medical facilities and designating a hospital we would use should something happen on that visit.
Yeah, there's always got to be some trauma center locally that you could rush the president to if necessary, right?
That's correct.
Okay, but you're literally with them. You get in the limousine, you're the decoy, as you say, and,
right.
and you travel to Andrews Air Force Base, get on board Air Force One. By the way, tell me about your first experience on Air Force One. There's another experience I'll never have, so I have to live it through you.
Well, you pinch yourself because it's a beautiful 747. In fact, there are two 747s. One's the primary plane, in which the president travels. The other is the backup plane, and they're configured the same way. The interior is a very nice, very tasteful southwestern color scheme, which Nancy Reagan had chosen. That plane's amazing. The forward part of the plane has the president's private sleeping compartment, his office, and then as you go towards the rear of the plane, the closest compartment to the president's space is the medical space where I usually sit.
Is there really an operating room on there?
It is. It's a fold-out table that's in the wall that you can open the wall cabinet and the table folds out. An operating room, light swings out. You have oxygen on board. You have a surgical kit if you ever have to do it. The goal is never have to operate while you're in the air. The only time I've ever had to do any type of procedure is we had a Secret Service agent cut her finger. She was bleeding profusely, and we're getting ready to land in Hawaii on one of Clinton's trips, and we sutured her on the plane because we just couldn't stop the bleeding.
Okay, so then you fly wherever the president is going, and most of the time you probably don't see him, do you?
You do. You follow him. You're in that entourage. When his agents are around him, you're in that perimeter with him. You're in the elevator with him, so you're within a few feet away from him.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean that you develop a personal relationship with them?
Oh, yeah. He sees you every day. He sort of looks at you or considers you after a while as sort of the household staff.
Uh-huh. Does that mean he says, you know what, I feel like some oranges. Go down and cut me up some oranges and bring them back up.
Yeah, whatever it takes. You know, like I need a glass of water. But he has other people who do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes he'll mention, you know, my throat's sore or my hand hurts or, you know, various things will come up. But a lot of times, you know, he's so absorbed in what he does, you become invisible. And your goal really is to be out of his personal space and be invisible. And you want to be close enough to respond if in case he needs you, but far enough away so that you're not in the kill zone.
All right. So, again, let's continue on the trip. You get off the Air Force One. You meet the local medical personnel, and you know where the hospital is, the trauma center. You might have to deal with, you know, God forbid you have to do that. But in the meantime, you're going in the motorcade to the hotel or the convention center or wherever it is, and he's going to make a speech. Where are you then?
You're behind stage. You can see him from behind stage. You're not in the crowd. You're hiding.
Uh-huh.
You're with the agents hiding behind stage.
In a special area that's been secured just in case something goes wrong yet again, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But you're watching him. You can see in case he passes out, in case he trips. And a lot of times with Clinton, if somebody in the audience had a medical problem, he would stop his speech, point to them, and then ask them over the microphone, do you need medical assistance? I'm sending my doctor in. So we would jump over these bicycle racks into the crowd during his campaign and resuscitate people in the audience.
Wow. Now, when you say we, it couldn't have been all of the medical staff because you still have to be on standby because of the specter of assassination hanging over you, right?
Right. It's usually my nurse or medic who's traveling with me. We also had other doctors, Army, Navy, Air Force doctors that we assigned to the vice president when he traveled. We had physician assistants who would also travel. And then, again, for every city you visited, you had either your nurse or your medic or your physician assistant from that team. So it took really a village to take care of the president and his entourage.
You also write in the book that with that specter hanging over you, that you had to make sure you stayed out of the kill zone. What is that?
That's the circle of within the president's, you know, the diameter around the president where he stands. I always think of when Reagan walked out of the Hilton Hotel in Washington, and James Brady was with him. James Brady was in the kill zone because the bullet came off of the limousine, deflected, and hit him.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to be right beside him. God forbid. You don't want to be there. You want to be about 5-10 feet away.
Yeah.
Don't be right behind him.
Because the marksman may not be that good a marksman.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
I mean, I'm joking about it, but obviously that is what's going through your mind while you're on that job, right?
Oh, yeah. You can't. You're constantly worried about that.
When you were first interviewed for the job, you write in the book that you thought you had no chance. Explain why.
Well, the traditional White House doctor was Caucasian male, West Point Naval Academy graduate, Ivy League medical school. And I was the first woman they had nominated. The only other woman who had been a White House doctor or presidential physician was Janet Travell. And she was a civilian physiatrist, a musculoskeletal expert that Kennedy had brought from New York. But she was there part-time. She would fly back and forth between New York. I was the first and only military woman they had nominated. So I didn't really fit their traditional mold when they nominated me.
Now, I know that women and men can both be fantastic doctors. I would never question your ability to do the job. But as a guy, when I go for a physical, certainly certain parts of that physical, I'm not comfortable having a woman doing those parts of the physical. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I respected that part. When the president would go for his annual exam at Bethesda, the chief of urology would be the one to do the prostate check. And the reason I liked having the chief of urology, he was a gruff old fellow, had been there for almost 30 years, and he examined all the president's predecessors. In fact, the urologist who took care of President Clinton had examined 5 other presidents. So I trusted his fingers more than mine.
But did you do the rest of the physical? You're checking out the rest of the president?
Exactly. Listen to his heart and lungs, check his abdomen. But we also brought in subspecialists. We had an ENT doctor who helped us, an allergist who helped us, a dermatologist who also got a good look at him, cardiologist. So you really had a team of people sort of blessing him along the way to make sure we were doing the right thing.
Because you were a military doctor, did you wear your dress military uniform on the job?
We didn't. The only person who travels with the president in full uniform is a military aide. We dress like Secret Service. In fact, you can't really tell who the doctor is, except for the one giveaway is the fact that that person has a big black bag and wears an earpiece and actually looks like Secret Service. We wear very plain navy blue black suits.
I want to explore your relationship with the Secret Service and talk more about this fascinating job, this life that you lived for nearly a decade. Dr. Connie Mariano's book is called The White House Doctor, My Patients Were Presidents. We'll come back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Harris. This is the John Brown Show on the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris filling in for John Brown, talking with Dr. Connie Mariano, Rear Admiral retired of the United States Navy. who had the unique position of White House doctor and writes about that in her new memoir called The White House Doctor, My Patients Were Presidents. How much training do you have to go through with the Secret Service when you're doing that job?
Quite a bit. As a minimum, White House doctors are board certified in internal medicine, family practice, or ER medicine. We're also certified, and a lot of us are instructors in advanced cardiac life support, advanced trauma life support. But on top of that, at least once a month, we go to Beltsville, which is the Secret Service training grounds, and there you actually participate in these exercises in which you simulate the president being attacked.
And who are you responsible for caring for besides the President of the United States?
Number one is the President, and then the Vice President, and then the First Lady, the First Family, the Vice President's family. But the size of our clinic actually expands. If the President has any special guests in the house, we take care of them. Any visitors to the 18 acres and anybody who works on the 18 acres of the White House grounds, we take care of them. And when the president travels on Air Force One, we take care of those folks. And then when the president's overseas, everyone in the entourage is eligible or actually is willing to receive our care as almost humanitarian basis. We take care of the people with them.
Safe to say all of these people are getting the best medical care I could possibly pay for?
Yeah, it's from the taxpayers. That's where, you know, they pay our salaries. That's where we get the pay.
Now, since you left the White House in 2001, did you miss the pretzel?
I did. It wasn't on my watch. It was on my successor's watch, Dr. Richard Tubb.
And since you got there in 1992, does that mean you also missed George H.W. Bush and the Prime Minister's lap?
I was really fortunate. Yeah, I missed those two. But I was the one who, Al Gore had his Achilles tendon surgery, Bill Clinton had his quadriceps surgery, and I had to draw the blood for Bill Clinton's DNA and was ordered to do so by Ken Starr.
Speaking of that, as someone who worked in the White House, were you subpoenaed in the Lewinsky matter?
I wasn't. Everybody else was, but I wasn't.
Very lucky.
I was.
Very lucky. Speaking of Mr. Clinton, I know that he always sounded hoarse. He always had voice problems, probably had allergies like I do. But I'm also guessing that as his doctor, you couldn't get him to stop talking, which would have helped a lot.
Absolutely. A lot of it was overuse. And actually, when you look at all the candidates for president during their campaign, usually their last speech before Election Day, they are all hoarse. So the White House doctor is the only one in America who can tell the president to shut up. And usually a time of year is the holiday season. The president's very hoarse. And I will pull him aside and say, you need to do something which is really impossible for Bill Clinton, which is voice rest.
But he didn't do it, did he?
No. In fact, everybody in the receiving line over the holidays, he'll say, my doctor says my voice is hoarse because I'm overusing it. I can't talk to you. And he would continue to talk.
Of course.
Telling them he can't talk.
Yeah. Well, that must have also been frustrating. You are approximately the most powerful doctor in the world because you're the personal physician to the president, but particularly with Bill Clinton, not just with his voice, but probably with the fast food and the diet and all the rest. You had a guy who really wasn't going to follow your advice all the time, right?
That's correct, and it's one of those few jobs I tell people you can actually see your patient be noncompliant. You follow them home. You're with them all the time. I mean, most of my patients' private practice now, I don't follow them home. I don't see whether they take their medicines. You try to tell them, yeah, you take your medicines, and you do all these things, and, you know, how much of that do they not tell you?
Yeah. You talked about the people that you helped with when you were on the road. When you were at the White House, you also sometimes had to even help out tourists on the White House tour, right?
We did. One of the early things that brand-new White House doctors do is they cover tours. So if anybody on the state floor gets dizzy, lightheaded trips, we send up a doctor and an assistant up there to the state floor to take a look at them.
Would you tell the story of the choking man at the Christmas party, which I guess was the last holiday party under the Bush administration?
It was. It was the last Christmas party Bush Sr. was having at the White House, and I got to attend with my husband, and we were all dressed up. We were guests. I didn't have the duty that night. We're in the beautiful state dining room, and there's this huge table that has all these wonderful foods on it, and the most popular item is these sumptuous cocktail shrimp. And there's a line up in front of it, and I had a little platter, and I was filling that up, and I look behind me, and there's a gentleman standing there grasping his throat, and there's another guy standing with him. And I looked at the gentleman touching his throat, and I asked him, are you all right? And his friend said, no, he's choking on the shrimp. And I said, can you breathe? And he just did this high-pitched sound, and I instantly came around him, told him to cough. He couldn't cough. I reached around behind him, did three abdominal thrusts Heimlich maneuver thrust, and he popped out the shrimp.
Did anybody know that there was an emergency going on in their midst at a holiday party?
Actually not, which I thought was amazing. I kept hoping nothing would happen further, because what happens is if you can't clear the obstruction and he becomes unconscious, you slide him down to the floor. You're supposed to straddle him and do abdominal thrusts. And I had a nice dress on. I wasn't about to straddle anybody in the state dining room. And when finally somebody did notice was the medical unit staff came over, and they brought him over to the men's room to clear out his mouth. And I asked my assistant, who finally showed up, I said, "Hey, I needed your help there for a moment. Didn't you see me?" And she goes, "Well, I did, but, you were so calm, I thought you were hugging him. I thought it was a friend." I said, "Well, not in that position."
Right in the middle of, I know you're not there with your black bag.
No.
So, yeah, well, that guy was very, very lucky that he had the right person there at the right time.
It wasn't his time yet.
Yeah. I mentioned that you were on the job from 92 to 01, which spanned not only the Clinton presidency, but the end of the Bush era and the beginning of the next Bush era. Why weren't you kept on as George W. Bush's personal physician?
Actually, they were wondering if I would stay on. His father, George Sr., when I got promoted to Admiral towards the end of Clinton, George Sr. sent me a very nice congratulatory letter and says, "My only regret is that you don't want to stay on." I was tired. It was 9 years. I had also received a wonderful offer to go to Mayo Clinic Scottsdale. And I at that point, you're done. You've had plenty of excitement. And my kids were 3 and 5 when I started. They were 12 and 14 when I finished that job. And, my successor was a great guy. He was ready to go, and he was a perfect match for W. Bush.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned you started out with Bush Sr. What's the transition like from one president to the next?
It really is different. It's almost like a dance you do. You have to adjust to their personality, to what their staff's personality is like. The thing about being at the White House as a holdover, you're always suspect because they wonder, well, wait a minute, what is your allegiance to the previous guy? So you really don't talk about the other guy. The focus is on the new guy who we serve.
Yep. Well, last question I've got to ask you about here. And by the way, you're terrific to talk to. I imagine that this is your bedside manner here. And, I can see why presidents would like having you around, or staff would like having you around, because you're very easy to talk to. But I want to go back to that first topic we talked about, that specter of assassination, and ask you about the 25th Amendment, which is the one that allows the president to voluntarily give up the power to the next in line, the vice president in most cases, temporarily, and then take it back later on.
Correct.
What's the doctor's role in applying the 25th Amendment, and did you ever have to do it?
Fortunately, never had to institute it. My predecessor did. And the role of the doctor is really advisory. You really just recommend, it's a political process that takes effect. In fact, most presidents, when they come into office, one of the first things they do is they have a big meeting with the doctor who they assign as the representative for them, the general counsel, the vice president, the chief of staff, and so forth, and they have an agreement. If I undergo anesthesia, if I'm unconscious, then the powers automatically go to the vice president, not the presidency, but the powers thereof. And so there's a huge meeting that happens where they write this out. There's a plans of succession. And it's a political process where the paperwork is drawn up, it's signed, it's brought up to Capitol Hill to be witnessed, and so forth. But the doctor really is more or less a consultant. You can't institute it. You can recommend it be instituted. Your role as White House doctor is, number one, do the right thing medically for your patient, make sure he gets appropriate care, and number two, be supportive of the Constitution as a military officer and say, based on what I'm finding as a physician, he's incapacitated. I recommend you all institute the 25th Amendment.
And in the book, you write about training that you had to go through with kind of testing you to see how you'd respond in a situation where the president might have been shot, and you end up in the backseat of the limo with the guy playing the president, his head in your lap, and you have to shout to the Secret Service guy, something about the 25th Amendment, right?
Absolutely. You have to not only try to save his life, but you have to realize who's in charge of the country now.
Yeah.
And that's always tagged on to any of those drills. And, and we learned from the past, when Reagan was shot and he went out, who was in charge? George Bush was flying, and everything sort of went on, and then it was supposed to be him in charge, and it was a little bit uncertain who was running the show. Alexander Haig said he was running the show.
Right. In fact, I think all the paperwork since then says, don't call Al Haig. Dr. Connie Mariano, the book is The White House Doctor, My Patients Were Presidents, a memoir. It is a terrific read, and I really enjoyed talking to you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Paul. My pleasure.